Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 16, which deals with the fighting in the city during the last week of September and the first week of October 1942. Remember last episode we covered the ongoing battles around the nail factory, Mamiev Hill, or Kurgan, and the grain elevator. The 62nd Army had experienced panic in the last week of September as the German divisions pushed hard against the Volga riverbank, cutting off parts of that army. But reinforcements from Siberia had been rushed across the Volga River into Stalingrad and arrived in the nick of time, bolstering the defenders. Another famous soldier had also arrived in the city in mid-September, and that was Sergeant Yakob Pavlov. He jumped off the lorry which had brought him and his companions to within 6 miles of Stalingrad on the east bank of the Volga. Sergeant Pavlov was part of the unit reinforcing Major General Alexander Radimtsev's much-depleted 13th Guards Division, which was concentrated around the Lazur Chemical Factory, an area known as the Tennis Racket due to a rail track that ran around the area which was shaped exactly like a tennis racket. Pavlov was a short, broad-shouldered man with penetrating grey eyes that surprised journalists who interviewed him after the war, as his eyes exuded warmth rather than the thousand-yard stare usually associated with veterans. He became known as the house owner and ended the war with a Golden Star of the Hero of the Soviet Union. That's double ironic because Pavlov never owned property his entire life. But he was a hero. The clue to his remarkable story is why he was dubbed with this nickname. And indeed, his story stands out in the annals of all those told about Stalingrad. Pavlov was born in a village not far from the source of the Volga River, far to the north in the province of Leningrad. He'd faced Hitler's forces in Poland in the early days of Operation Barbarossa, particularly those of Field Marshal von Bock's Central Group. Since June 1941, he'd experienced nothing but fighting retreats. Now he was facing Hitler's war machine at a place marking their most eastern advance, which was a further irony considering what he was going to do. There'll be no more retreating for Sergeant Pavlov. I'll come back to his story through the series. The Russians had now altered their tactics, owing largely to General Choikov's realization that small platoons based inside buildings were literally a garrison all by themselves. Secondly, by placing the platoons within 50 yards of the Germans, the Luftwaffe could not be used as ground support by the 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army. Thirdly, it would have been the height of military incompetence to have attempted to employ large groups of soldiers in frontal assaults on the German positions. Instead, Choikov created small parties of around a dozen men led by veteran NCOs or officers and then given specific objectives. They would dislodge a house of Germans, then refuse to be dislodged in turn. Of course, the Germans very quickly learned how to use the same tactics, but the Russians were masters of hand-to-hand fighting inside apartment blocks and particularly at night. The shock troop platoon was born of the Rattenkrieg, the Rat War of Stalingrad. Choikov had a very clear plan of action. In the first stage of fighting, the enemy seized positions such as Mamiev Hill and the Central Railway Station. Before defensive positions could be consolidated, the Russians tried to dislodge them using highly mobile, quick-moving units. This lasted several weeks at the start of the assault on Stalingrad. The second stage was now, at the end of September, when the enemy had established a continuous defense line securing logistic support and developing a network of firepower like machine guns and artillery ranging in on specific targets. In this stage, the small group could not succeed on its own, but was used as the attacking spearhead. Soon after it took a strong position from the Germans, the larger reinforcement group arrived to increase the firepower at that position. Then the third group, known as the reserves, would bolster the other two. These three groups are what caused the Germans a great deal of trouble in Stalingrad. Sergeant Pavlov was particularly good as the leader of the shock group, the first 8 to 12 man units that attacked suddenly and usually at night. They rushed an objective from various points and then would go through the building towards a predetermined specific room, destroying the enemy as they went. They were lightly armed, usually with Tommy guns, grenades, a dagger and a spade. The Stalingrad spade was quite a feat of local engineering. It had a short handle which could also be used as a grenade thrower. Its edges were sharp and it turned into an axe during hand-to-hand fighting. One side of this axe was sharpened to a razor-like consistency, and that would be used to slit the throats of Germans. The reinforcement group or second were more heavily armed with machine guns, anti-tank rifles, mortars, cannon, crowbars, picks and explosive charges. What is interesting is how these three different groups were trained. Each man was trained to do the job of each group, so that when groups were wiped out, others could easily take their place. Speed and surprise were the two factors that built the Russians' reputation in Stalingrad. At the Railwayman's house in the city, for example, a shock group attacked at 10 a.m. By 10.03 a.m., the building had been taken. The German garrison of two infantry companies surrendered. Probably no campaign in military history has produced such an army of individual fighting men confident in their strength and personal judgment as the Russians in Stalingrad in 1942. Meanwhile, Adolf Hitler was lashing out. Remember, he had fired the chief of the army general staff, Halder, on the 24th of September. He had also fired General List, who had led Army Group A, of which the 1st Panzer Army was part. They had failed to take the Caucasus oil fields. When Jodl told Hitler that List had merely been following his orders, Jodl was fired as well. At this very moment, Hitler changed his daily routine and withdrew from his offices. He would stay away from common meals and never left his hut during the day. From now on, all reports had to be delivered to him in his little hut with a small group of sycophants. He refused to shake hands with any members of the top officer corps. Something had snapped in the little corporal. Back in Stalingrad, however, the Russian defensive position was incredibly weak. Choikov's armies had survived what became known as the Day of Death on the 22nd of September 1942, where the 13th Division faced a battle for its very survival. The Germans planned a major breakthrough to the Volga, encircling the defenders of central Stalingrad and destroying them on the banks of the river. This was an all-out offensive on the 62nd Army, and it came very close to success. Yet, the courageous defiance of the 13th Guards, pushed back to within 200 meters of the river, prevented catastrophe. Their heroic stand planted a powerful idea amongst the entire army. It was still possible to resist the enemy, even if thrown back to the very edge of the Volga. Stalingrad's defenders were now utterly reliant on a counterattack by other Russian armies on the front to head off this offensive. "It could have changed the situation in our favor," said Choikov, "but this did not happen." He was angry. The 62nd Army had been hoping against hope for support from its fellows. Now it was facing a ghastly alternative. It would have to take on the assembled might of the Germans on its own. Its sense of isolation worsened as the enemy intensified the bombardment of the Volga. For the German, Romanian, and Russian armies on the southern flank, they had settled into what amounted to First World War trench combat. The weapons were improved, and there were more effective aircraft offering ground support, yet they were pretty much back in the cold, muddy trenches, trying to survive massive artillery barrages. For the armoured formations who'd spent the last 2 months speeding across the steppe almost like warships, the change was deeply depressing. The lack of trees and mountains made southern Germans and Austrians homesick. As they looked out at the rain soaking the flat land, they tried to ignore the water rising above their ankles and the wet rats feasting on the corpses in no man's land. They had settled into a frozen war scenario here in the south. Unlike the 6th Army inside Stalingrad, which was a fireball of hell, face-to-face killings at night, grenades and constant noise and smoke. Here in the south, German units would be ordered to reconnoitre the area at night, or small night assaults would be ordered where they'd creep up to Russian lines and lob a few grenades and run back. A more general tactic evolved at this time, the use of night attacks by the Russian Air Force, as Choikov realized the Germans were short of reserves. As we heard last week, there was only one division Paulus was holding in reserve. 11 others were strung across 130 miles of the steppe, protecting his flanks. Only 8 divisions were actively fighting inside Stalingrad itself. Choikov also believed that the Germans were more afraid of the night than his own soldiers and wanted them to feel the pain of night fighting. The German Lanza came to harbour a special fear of Colonel Batyuk's Siberians of the 284th Rifle Division, who were thought to be excellent hunters of anything, including human beings. German sentries would open fire at the slightest sound at night, sending chasers peeling off into the dark at any rustling noises. These fusillades contributed to German expenditure of over 25 million rounds during September 1942 alone. The Red Army Air Wing purposefully flew nights to keep the Germans from sleep, while on the ground, Russians would fire flares at odd times to give the impression an attack was imminent. One of their psychological weapons was a small biplane known as the B-2, not to be confused with the American stealth aircraft Many women flew these planes and learned a few special tricks. I explained these in an earlier podcast, but just for reference, they would switch off their engines as they came in on a bombing raid on a trench. The Germans heard a faint whistling of the wind through the biplane stays and struts, which added to their paranoia as the bird of prey dived down in the dark. When ticking over, the B-2's engine had a curious buzzing sound and gave this old-fashioned aircraft one of its nicknames, sewing machine. No other machine attracted more nicknames, in some ways more fear, than this little beast.
"We lie exhausted in our holes waiting for them," wrote a German soldier.
It was also known as the Duty NCO because of the way it crept up unannounced. Other names were the Midnight Bomber, the Coffee Machine, and the Railway Crow. The Luftwaffe were expected to combat these night raids, but failed.
"The Russians' unchallenged air superiority at night has reached an unbearable level," went one report to Paulus. "The troops get no rest and their strength will soon be completely dissipated."
General Paulus himself was a nervous wreck at this point. He could just not take Stalingrad and everyone was pressurizing him. So, at 0600 hours on the morning of Sunday 27th of September, his renewed offensive began with concentrated Stuka bombings. Two panzer divisions and five infantry divisions then mobilized to crush the main Russian salient, which stuck out in a triangular shape from the west bank of the Volga. Zhukov wasn't going to be taken so easily. His 62nd Army attacked the main thrust of the German operation north of Mamiev Kurgan, with other spoiling attacks on the south side. General Paulus had decided to strike head-on at his adversary's strongest point. It was the area where the tractor factory, the Barakaidi, and the Lazur chemical plant tennis racket buildings were in the north of Stalingrad. These three ranged one after the other a few hundred feet from the Volga bank. Picture the scene, if you will. I have explained how the Russians went about their attacks with dollops of ammunition and grenades and very little else. The heavily laden German troops started to move forward on that morning at snail's pace, very much like their ancestors at Verdun. On the left, the 389th Infantry Division prepared to advance towards the Barakaidi workers' housing. A Luftwaffe bombing run set these white-painted buildings ablaze. In the middle, the 24th Panzer Division pushed forward from a small airfield. The Austrian 100 Jager Division attacked the Red October workers' settlements. At the base of the flank of this unit, the top of Mamiev Kurgan was taken from Garishny's 95th Rifle Division, which had been hammered by the artillery and air bombardment. This was a crucial 24-hour period in the history of this battle. Choikov wrote later that,
"One more battle like that and we'll be in the Volga."
Khrushchev rang him and asked about the morale. What could Choikov say? The 95th Rifle Division had been flattened and the 62nd was doing all it could to halt this big German offensive. The next morning, 28th of September, the Luftwaffe targeted the west bank of the Volga, where Russian shipping concentrated, trying to cut off the 62nd Army's lifeline. Women, who were the main anti-aircraft gunners, reported later that the rifling on the AK-AK guns had been worn smooth by the rate of fire, but they couldn't halt the Luftwaffe, and soon five out of the six supply boats were out of action. Choikov ordered additional units to try and retake Mamiev Kurgan, and they forced the Germans off the all-important summit. However, neither side held the strategic high ground. It had now become a no-man's land between the two sides. So Choikov had managed to stop the Germans controlling the summit, which meant they could not range their artillery as effectively. A small victory in a sea of pain. But the shipping loss meant there were now thousands of wounded Russian troops lying on the west bank of the Volga, and frontline troops were starting to run out of ammunition as their link to the east bank was almost shut down. On Tuesday, 29th of September, the Germans aimed straight at the apex of the Russian salient triangle. The village of Orlovka was attacked from the west by elements of the 389th Infantry Division, as well as from the northeast by the 60th Motorized Division. The Red Army 389th was heavily outnumbered but somehow managed to hold out. The next day, the 30th, 60th Motorized and 16th Panzer Divisions destroyed 72 Russian tanks, as well as crushing two Soviet rifle divisions and three tank brigades. And yet, still, the Russians held on. This village of Orlovka would see battle lines move to and fro for the next 10 days. Now the 24th Panzer Division, most of the 389th Infantry Division and the 100th Jager advanced towards the Red October metalworks as well as the Barakaidi gun factory. This is where the Germans would pick up very heavy casualties. One Austrian soldier from the Jager wrote home.
The confused tangle of a completely destroyed factory area. Inside, the comrades were falling. The cries for medical orderlies increased. The fire intensified, but not just from the front. It was now also coming from both sides.
The rubble and twisted metal caused more wounds as grenades blew bits off these as shrapnel, increasing heavy casualties amongst the Germans. General Paulus ordered the 94th Infantry and the 14th Panzer Divisions up from the south to try to take the Red October and Barricade plots. But the Russians were also receiving badly needed reinforcements in the form of General Stepan Guriev's 39th Guards Division, which ran off their ferry and straight towards the Germans at the Red October plant. It was going to be touch and go. General Choikov now faced his own special danger. On the 1st of October, the German 295th Infantry Division managed to infiltrate down the gullies on Radimtsev's right flank. Despite desperate hand-to-hand fighting once more, the Germans managed to clamber through the main sewer in Krutoy Gully and finally reached the Volga. These men then turned south and attacked Radimtsev's flank and rear. Another German raid broke through in the north, but both were eventually pushed back. Hundreds died in these two assaults alone. It was the next day, the 2nd of October, that was almost Chokov's last day on the planet. Remember, I explained last episode that his HQ was actually a trench below oil storage tanks, which were supposed to be empty. The Germans attacked these, and they were not empty after all. Direct hits from both shells and bombs set them on fire. The burning oil poured down the hill straight towards Choikov's trench, but slightly raised ground meant the flow was deflected around their positions like lava and into the Volga River. From the east side of the Volga, senior officers watched with horror. General Yeremenko's officers radioed Choikov and asked, "Where are you?"
"Where the most smoke and flames are," replied Choikov.
He'd survived being barbecued by the skin of his teeth. It was now the first week of October, and still the Germans could not take Stalingrad. Paulus' 6th Army had been mauled, and he had no reinforcements. His men were exhausted after the week of fighting non-stop. So we too must halt the podcast and take stock. An unbelievable battle was becoming more historic by the hour. Next week we'll focus on the German response and join Sergeant Pavlov as he grimly hangs on to what became known as Pavlov's house. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have time. Any suggestions, please feel free to contact me through the website abwarpodcast.com or direct message me on Twitter @DesLatham. Until next week, goodbye.